Hi, welcome back to AR Zone. I'm your host, Carolyn Bailey. These continuing interviews on anti-oppression, veganism, and related issues are in association with VegFest UK. In today's interview, we're very happy to welcome back to AR Zone Dr. Casey Taft. Casey is co-owner of Vegan Publishers and Professor of Psychiatry at Boston University School of Medicine. He's an internationally recognized psychologist and clinical researcher, winning prestigious awards for his work. He's published over 100 journal articles, book chapters, and scientific reports, and has recently authored Millennial Vegan, Motivational Methods for Vegan Advocacy, and Trauma-Induced Treatment and Prevention of Intimate Partner Violence. It's a pleasure to welcome you back to AR Zone, Casey.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
You're very welcome, Casey. Casey, you're going to have a really busy weekend in Brighton at VegFest UK this weekend. I know you have a number of talks and panels that you'll be part of. One of your talks is Motivational Methods for Animal Advocacy, in which you'll focus on how we can most effectively motivate non-vegans to become vegan from a behavioural change perspective. Would you please explain what this talk will involve and why it's so important to be impactful communicators?
This was based on a book that I wrote a few years ago, and it's sort of, it's a talk that I've kind of used a lot, and it's, you know, it's evolved a little bit, and I'm looking forward to updating it a bit for the VegFest. But honestly, I found that it sort of stands up over time, which I'm glad about, because when I was writing this book and I was giving these talks, you know, I didn't know. I assumed that, you know, years down the road, I'd look back at it and be really embarrassed, because that's often what happens with things that I write, because, you know, things change and we evolve and, you know, our advocacy evolves. But I find that a lot of the things in this talk and a lot of the things I wrote about in my book are, you know, especially salient now. You know, I think when I wrote my book, I was especially concerned about this whole wave of reducitarianism and folks, you know, asking people just to cut down on, you know, consuming animals rather than going vegan. And I was really concerned about that. I was really concerned about all of this sort of, you know, what I refer to as kind of bogus pseudoscientific research looking into different forms of advocacy that seem really clearly, you know, where you have the large groups and folks like animal charities evaluators that are really trying to push for reducitarianism instead of veganism and, you know, go vegetarian instead of go vegan. And a lot of this kind of messaging, a lot of these forces that, you know, I thought were really threatening the movement. And, you know, lo and behold, it seems, you know, 3 years later that these forces seem to have only kind of gotten stronger. So I still feel like, you know, the talk and the book is especially relevant. But to answer the second part of your question, you know, why is it important how we communicate with others? There's a fair amount of evidence. There isn't a lot of like good research on animal advocacy, but there is evidence out there that probably the largest determinant of whether other people go vegan is who they have in their social networks and who they come in contact with. So, and I truly believe that, you know, we as the grassroots, you know, the folks on the ground who are talking to people, who are influencing, you know, loved ones and friends, acquaintances, folks on social media, we're the ones that are ultimately, it's really up to us whether we're going to kind of change the tide and, you know, ultimately have that vegan world that we all want. So I think it's really important how we communicate with people, because we're all kind of agents of social change and social influence. So I think how we engage in advocacy is really important. And I didn't think that the guides that had been written and some of the advice that's typically given out there was, you know, especially useful or correct.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, Casey. You've also often spoken about goal setting. You wrote about that in your book, Motivational Methods for Vegan Advocacy. Recently, Trent Gracian has published some very important research that also covers goal setting and the difference in results between setting solid goals and setting more vague goals, such as just reducing something at some time. If you've had time to read Trent's research, would you like to comment on that and add your own perspective on goal setting and the importance of setting solid goals?
You know, I've been in touch with Trent over the years, and he's told me about his dissertation, and I was really happy that it's done, you know, for his own sake, so he can get his PhD, but also it seems it's really important work. He hasn't released the full report, so I haven't got to look at, you know, the actual data, the actual results and that sort of thing, which I'm really looking forward to doing, and kind of ultimately, you know, seeing him get it published in a peer-reviewed journal and all that kind of good stuff, which I know he's planning on doing. I have seen the summary of the results, and kind of consistent with what I've been saying, and honestly what psychologists have been saying, you know, for millennia, is that if you want folks to achieve a certain goal, you have to be really clear, really specific about that goal, and choose a big goal rather than a small goal. There's a whole field of research on this, looking at goal setting, and it's very clear that the clearer the goal is and the harder it is, then folks have something to kind of mark their progress. They have something to work towards. If you just tell somebody, and this is what kind of a lot of, you know, reducitarian messaging is like, you know, they're just like, well, kind of do your best, you know, or this mindset of so many folks like online, you see, well, every bit counts, just do what you can. And, you know, that may feel good, but it's ultimately not what's going to bring about the changes we need. It's ultimately what's not best for the animals, because what happens is, you know, folks will just like not really do anything, and they'll say, well, I'm doing the best that I can. And then, okay, you have achieved your goal, you know, and which means, you know, most of the time you've achieved nothing. You haven't really made any lasting changes. So if you want to set a goal, it's really important to be really clear and choose a challenging goal. So the work that I do, I in my day job, you know, I do programs to prevent violence, especially domestic violence. And it's always a goal that I have with the folks I work with, that the goal is to remain totally nonviolent. Like, that's a given. Like, of course that's a goal. And it should be the same thing. We as vegan advocates trying to help people go vegan, if you want people to go vegan, you have to set a vegan goal. Like, people aren't just going to stumble upon it, you know, make a series of small changes, and suddenly they wake up one day and like they didn't even realize, but like poof, they're vegan. Like, that's not really how it works, you know. So it's just common sense, and it's also, there's a lot of social science research behind it. I'm glad that now there's research in animal advocacy that supports it too.
Absolutely. And setting vegan goals and encouraging other people to set vegan goals is not the same as saying, like, go vegan or do nothing. It's not an all or nothing approach, which a lot of the reducitarians often accuse it of being. It's just having solid goals. It doesn't mean that you have to go vegan overnight. It just means that your end goal is to live vegan, as opposed to reduce something about something at some time.
Well, first of all, I feel I would never compromise my own ethics by suggesting to somebody that it's okay to continue to harm animals in moderation. So, I mean, that should be kind of a non-starter, you know, that we as animal advocates, vegan advocates, we should never compromise the animals in our advocacy. So I couldn't even do that, even if I thought it was effective, but it's not. And the truth is, if we talk about veganism, we talk about ending the harm we do to non-human animals. And this is what Trent's research showed, that folks will not only be more likely to go vegan, but they're also going to be more likely to reduce their animal use consumption. So, and this is something I've been trying to say for a long time, but I don't know if I've clearly made that point, that just telling people to reduce their use of animals, promoting reducitarian goals, is not even the best way to have reducitarianism. It's not even the best way to get people to reduce. If you really want people to reduce, talk to them about harder goals, like setting a vegan goal. Talk to them about veganism. And the person that you're talking to will make that decision about how they're going to work towards that goal. You know, what I think often happens is we sell people short. You know, we assume that they can't make big changes, so we don't ask for big changes. When the truth is, you know, we have to give people more credit for that. And some people are capable of making big changes right away. And if we just wouldn't be afraid to talk about veganism, then they would go ahead and do that. You know, or at least work more towards it than if we just said, well, why don't you just like cut out eating one kind of animal, you know, and then next month you can stop eating a different animal. Like, we have to give people more credit for that. So I think part of this is like empowering people to know what changes they need to make, and empowering people to make those changes rather than trying to tell them like your goal should be like very minimal.
Absolutely. And reducitarian goals usually only address the other animals who we eat. Reducitarianism doesn't usually address entertainment and clothing and experimentation and that sort of thing. So we're really not even addressing the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, like, not honestly, like, none of it makes any sense. Like, I don't know why so many people get on board with that. Like, because, I mean, our strongest argument is clearly we have no need to be doing any of this, right? I mean, our strongest argument is the ethical argument. And even for the research that, you know, the kind of pseudo-scientific research that's been done in the animal advocacy world, even they find that those who abstain from using animals for ethical reasons are the ones who remain abstainers. Hmm. So we do know, I mean, it's very clear that health arguments and other kind of arguments are not as strong as ethical arguments because it's really simple. It's really straightforward. We have no need to be using animals for any reason, so we ought not do it. I mean, it's not up to us to determine whether other animals should live or die. I mean, it's a pretty basic argument. I think at the core, most people understand it. I think most people know that it's wrong to use animals. We just have to find a way to connect with them around them.
Thanks, Casey.
So, hi, Casey. Roger here.
Hey, Roger.
Hi, how are you doing? Just before my question, just a comment on what you've just said and to repeat what I said during the Trent podcast. We've noticed on the street in the last few years that people do seem to have their own solid goals, and they come to us and they say, you know, my aim is to go vegan, but I'm not there yet. They know where they're going. You don't have to kind of, as it were, hide it from them. I think that's one of the worst things about vegetarianism for me is this kind of notion that people just can't kind of take it. You know, you're going to blow their mind. You're going to put them off things for life. And, you know, it doesn't kind of compute for me, really, to be honest.
Yeah, well, and you know, maybe part of it is that these advocates are just not confident in their abilities. You know, maybe they're not especially effective advocates, you know, so maybe they feel like they can't just be honest with people. But I mean, really, the most influential people, the most effective advocates are the ones who can be real with other people and be honest and give a message in a way where you're not threatening the other person, you're not demeaning the other person, but you're getting the clear message across. You know, so I think for some people, maybe they just feel like they can't be honest. Like I don't really understand it. For my own kind of vegan story, for many years, I was more plant-based, where I actually thought I was vegan, like a lot of people we know, where they think they're vegan, but they're really not, you know. I mean, I thought I was vegan because I was on a plant-based diet for many years. But, you know, like I would kind of waver and, you know, and here and there, depending on like what was going on in my social life, maybe if I was dating a non-vegan, I would, you know, cheat here and there. And it really wasn't until like a friend of mine was really straight with me and was like, why, you know, you know what you're doing is wrong. Like you need to cut it out and go vegan. And I was like, you know what? You're right. And that was it. And I went vegan then. And that was it. Just somebody had to just like be honest with me and be real with me. And then I just made that connection and I totally knew they were right. And I think that would happen a lot more if people weren't so afraid of just being honest with people.
Yeah, I think you're right. Honesty is good. I want to pick your kind of psychologist brain a little. I'm not looking for you to get involved with psychoanalysis or anything. It's just that I've been
this is gonna get good. Okay, let's do it.
You know, I've been part of the grassroots for many years. You know, the grassroots are often struggling, and the grassroots are often, you know, living from hand to mouth and everything. And so, for me, when I heard about this idea to give the Pope $1 million to go vegan, which meant eat plants for 6 or 7 weeks, I was absolutely flabbergasted, literally kind of floored by it, you know. And I just wonder, you know, are the people in the mainstream groups, the rich groups, so disconnected from the grassroots that they just don't understand what it's like to be on the ground talking to people, you know, sometimes 3 times a week, you know, that they would come up with such a, for me, a completely pathetic idea. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I hate to laugh because it's sad, right? And it's and people get caught up in it too. You know, I feel like they use people kind of to kind of try to push these campaigns. People get caught up in it without really knowing better because they might not really understand the background behind it and why this is wrong, you know, and how harmful it is to the vegan message to kind of talk this, you know, to promote it as something that you can just kind of switch on and off and that you can kind of try for a little while. And that is something that you could buy. You know, it's just it is kind of dumbfounding to me how so many people get behind things like this. I don't really understand it either. It seems like such a colossal waste of money that, like you said, you know, say it could go to the grassroots. So much good could be done with $1 million. Instead, we're talking about just kind of blowing it, you know, and who knows where the money would even go for some kind of media stunt. And, you know, we know these kinds of stunts don't really aren't especially effective, and they don't really promote veganism in the way that we really want to promote veganism as, you know, as a matter of ethics. So, yeah, I wish I could understand it too. There's a lot that happens in the movement that's disappointing. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm in Ireland, as you know. I mean, there's one guy who's on the street every week, and he's been on there for like 4 years now. And he also runs a vegan animal sanctuary, and they've got 400 other animals to look after and stuff. And, you know, they're kind of struggling, really. And it just seemed to me to be such a kind of like a disconnect going on. You know, it just seemed bizarre that, you know, if you like the, you know, I don't know, the kind of paid staff or the people who come up with these big fancy ideas. I mean, let's face it, going back to what you just said, we have a multimillionaire vegetarian being the lead celebrity of a campaign asking the Pope to, quote, go vegan for 7 weeks. It just didn't make any sense to me at all, you know.
I also know a lot of folks who could really use the help, you know, folks with animal sanctuaries, folks who are, you know, they're right there, you know, trying to take care of the animals. And so it's really sad to me that so much money gets diverted to these kinds of groups that they could just throw away $1 million like it's nothing, when it would mean so much to so many other people. I mean, this to me is kind of one of the reasons why I wrote my book and why I give these talks, is because I feel like these kind of pseudoscience and this reducitarianism, like all of these kind of streams in the movement are, you know, at least partially designed to siphon money out of the grassroots and siphon it into these large organizations that are counterproductive in so many ways.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I reckon that $1 million would run the grassroots movement in Ireland for about 25 years. It's kind of ridiculous. Anyway, before I get tearful, I'll hand this over back to Carolyn to ask you one of her outrageously long questions.
Okay. You'll get in trouble for that, Roger. Casey, one of your other talks at VegFest UK will cover trauma in animal advocacy. Animal advocates often face trauma in regard to how we view the non-vegan world and the violence that many others see as the norm. That really can be devastating at times and really, really difficult. I'd like to speak with you about a different type of trauma, though, first. I'd like to ask you about the abuse, bullying and trauma within the movement. We've all seen advocates disagree with advocacy styles and with how different people choose to advocate, but there's a deeper bullying and abuse going on. I've experienced it, and I know others who have as well. I'm talking about advocates who use the movement to discredit and to ostracize others who disagree with them, contacting mutual friends and bullying them to disassociate with the targeted subject, referring to the target as racist or speciesist, for example, or all sorts of other names, as a form of oppression hierarchy to discredit them, and forming something of a pack mentality to force the target out of specific groups. We very rarely speak about this, and it's happening more often than most people realise. Are you able to address this and offer some advice and or encouragement about it to those people who have been targeted?
Yeah, so this is another issue that I've been really concerned about, because this is really what I do in my day job, is I work with those who engage in violence, especially intimate partner violence. So I'm at an advantage because when it's happening to me, I know exactly what's happening and why it's happening. But I'll tell you, even though I'm prepared and I have this background, I have this experience, and, you know, I'm considered like one of the leaders in this field, it still affects me. there's really no way that it can't, you know, especially because I think a lot of this abuse is really not overt. And that's what's so difficult about more psychological or emotional abuse, is that, you know, at some point, you know, it's hard for others to recognize it. So, and others can unknowingly participate in it, you know, by supporting abusive folks in the movement, by kind of denying or minimizing the abuse, you know, whether they're doing it intentionally or not, by kind of distancing themselves from folks who are being abused. And I think it just gets more complicated in the movement, because, you know, it's not always clear, like, who is the abuser and who's the victim, right? Because oftentimes the abuser is claiming to be the victim at the same time. And these situations are often really complex. And we're kind of taught, you know, just believe victims, right? If anybody, you know, describes themselves as a victim, we're supposed to believe them. However, there are some times where folks who describe themselves as victims are really extremely abusive, right? So I think, like, folks get all these conflicting messages, and usually they err on the side of believing folks when they say things. So I think it just makes it really complicated. And for some folks, they don't really know how to respond, you know, and it's very challenging. It's been challenging for me. I've experienced a lot of it myself. You know, when I first started talking about trauma in the movement, this was, I think, a year or two ago, when there was a lot of abuse, you know, in the abolitionist movement in particular. And I think more recently, we're seeing a lot of this in the intersectional movement or the pro-intersectional movement. So it's not like this abuse is limited to any specific group of people, you know, like it happens in every area of the animal movement. You know, a lot of the misanthropes, you know, are also very abusive. A lot of the antinatalist folks, like, it's in every area of animal advocacy. So, and we've talked about this. I've talked to many others in the movement. There's a lot of folks who've dropped out of the movement entirely because of this. And there's a lot of folks whose mental health has really deteriorated because of this. So this is a really serious issue. And I really am concerned for other advocates who just experience this on a regular basis. I mean, it's hard enough when we're constantly exposed to violence and trauma towards non-human animals, and we're, you know, we are often socially isolated from, you know, family and have other kinds of issues just from being animal advocates. It's hard enough. And then to deal with it, direct abuse on top of it, is just really, you know, just really a struggle for a lot of folks.
One of the problems could be that when others are dragged into something, say, for example, somebody wants to discredit me, for example, and they'll contact one of my friends and drag one of my friends in, that person is in a position where they have to decide to either believe that person and support that person, or mm-hmm. become a target themselves.
Right. Yep.
And I think that's where a lot of people will back down.
And yeah.
That kind of perpetuates the problem.
Definitely. And I can tell you, I've been pressured into alienating people like that. Yep. That's happened with me too. And, you know, I've been on both sides of it. Been pressured, and I've also had people being pressured to not have, you know, not to deal with me. And it's really challenging. And, you know, all I will suggest is that folks, you know, and I know this from the work that I do, that there's often many different sides to every story, right? And just about every abusive man that I work with describes himself as innocent, and he says his partner's the one to blame. And I know that there's another side of the story, usually the way it is. So I don't necessarily take what people say at face value. I just consider there's probably another side to it. And I require direct evidence before I make any kind of judgments about anything. Like, I won't just take somebody's interpretation. I just won't accept that without really thinking critically about it, because the work that I do and the research that I do really shows that people, especially people who've experienced trauma, you know, and God knows that us in the movement have experienced a lot of trauma in various ways. That can really affect how you interpret situations. And oftentimes what happens, and I've done a lot of research on this, when you've experienced trauma and you have, you know, problems such as PTSD, what happens is you go into this kind of survival mode mindset where you assume that other people have negative intentions towards you. When you go into this kind of survival mode, you're going to assume the worst in people, and you're going to assume that other people are a threat to you in one way or another. And usually what happens is your interpretations are biased. I've seen this happen a lot, and it's happened to me a lot, where I've had folks assume that I was trying to harm them in some way, or assume that I have negative intentions towards them in some way. And I personally knew that I knew that this was because of their past experiences, that trauma that others have inflicted on them, where they came to assume that I was doing the same thing, or I had some negative intentions. And that was far from the truth. And, you know, typically is exactly the opposite, where I was actually trying to help them in different ways. But it's amazing, you know, how trauma and these negative experiences can really cause people to assume the worst in people, to kind of make other people the enemy, and kind of bring other people into this dynamic and create an abusive situation.
Thanks, Casey. I think that's really good advice and really good information and very helpful. I want to thank you so much also for spending your time with us today. I know it's a busy time for you. I want to wish you all the very best at VegFest UK this weekend. I hope everything goes wonderfully. Safe travels and have lots of really nice food too. And thank you very much for everything that you're doing. What you're doing for both humans and other animals is incredibly important, and it's really very much appreciated.
And Casey, before you answer that, I know Carolyn likes to end on an upbeat note. So how's the kids? How's the kids?
they're good. So I have a 5.5-year-old, Lena, who she recently started her own YouTube channel called Vegan Beans. So she's really excited. She wants to try to create a community for vegan kids, because on YouTube there really isn't much for vegan kids. So that's a little plug for her. And our other little girl, Cecily, just turned one. So she's walking now, and she's getting into all kinds of trouble and, you know, running us ragged, but they're good. Thanks for asking that.
Oh, I don't know. You know, I think there's loads for vegan kids on YouTube. Yourofsky, Vegan Games.
That's a joke that only animal rights advocates can really appreciate.
Absolutely. I saw Lena's first YouTube video. She's doing a wonderful job. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, she thinks she's a YouTube star. She it's funny. She assumes that everybody knows her. And actually, she did do a video on our vegan publishers page that has something like 100 million views. Maybe it's like 80 or 90 million views or something like that. Wow. It was something, it didn't even have anything to do with veganism. It was just a Christmas gift where she got a microphone and she's like yelling out to her mother. And it went totally viral on Facebook. And recently I took her to the dentist's office, and when they found out that she did that video, they all flipped out. Like, everybody has seen this video. We've had like family members who forwarded the video to us, not knowing that it was her. So like in a way, she is kind of a social media star, even though most people like wouldn't know I'm looking at her feed. But anyway, yeah. So she loves it.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's funny.
Thanks again, Casey. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you. Nurses past maturity. No member of the animal kingdom ever did a thing to me. So I don't eat red meat or white meat.